Oh boy, we are jammed with holidays and events for the week spanning episode 161 of The Far Middle. Got Father's Day this past weekend, Flag Day as well, Juneteenth on our day of episode premiere, and then tomorrow marks the official beginning of summer, so hallelujah to all of them. And greetings to all of you constant listeners from your host, Nick DeOlias. This week's episode encompasses a consistent theme of compare and contrast, of binary opposites, of pairings, of issues of distraction versus issues of reality. In some ways, a twinning of polar opposites. We'll walk through three such pairings, and I think you're going to enjoy the compare and contrast of each. So let's get started. We will begin with the sports dedication, as we always do, and it's a person who ties quite well into the theme of pairings, because he dominated for a time not one but two, a pair of pro sports. And this person also connects to a university we'll discuss in a moment. So here's a question for you sports and non-sports fans alike. Who was the greatest all-around pro athlete of a generation that also was one of the biggest marketing successes of a generation? Last episode, you'll recall in our Sonny Vaccaro sports dedication, we talked a little MJ or Michael Jordan, but his feats on the baseball diamond, they were somewhat mediocre, certainly not great. How about someone who clearly reigned at the top of two pro sports, who was a human highlight film, and who sparked a massive ad campaign that rivaled Air Jordan's? At about the same time, by the way, just a few years after the Air Jordan campaign kicked off, and with the same company Jordan sponsored with, which was Nike. Do you know who it is? He knows, as in Bo knows. Now you probably know. Yeah, Bo Jackson. Jackson's name became legend beyond just sports through the Bo Knows advertising campaign, which is a series of ads by Nike starring Jackson alongside musician Bo Diddley, promoting a cross-training athletic shoe named for Jackson. Bo won the Heisman as a running back in college at Auburn. He was selected by the New York Yankees in the second round of the 1982 Major League Baseball draft before he played college football, but he instead, of course, chose to attend Auburn on a football scholarship because he promised his mom he would be the first in the family to go to a major college. And he eventually got his degree, by the way. He played pro baseball before football. And that's an interesting story that either you forgot or you might not be aware of, how he ended up playing baseball before football in the pros. So during his senior year at Auburn, Jackson transitioned his focus to baseball and became increasingly vocal about his unwillingness to play in the NFL. And a month before the 1986 NFL draft, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, the owner of the Buccaneers, they took Bo on a visit with the team. And Jackson was told by the Buccaneers that the trip had been cleared by the NCAA and the SEC. But guess what? In truth, it was not cleared. And Bo was declared ineligible near the tail end of his senior baseball season, and that didn't sit well with him. So years later, Jackson told ESPN that he was long of the mind that the Buccaneers, they sabotaged his collegiate baseball career to make it more likely he would turn to football and be drafted by the Buccaneers. And he was so upset at the Buccaneers' actions that he vowed never to play a down for them. Now, despite his threat, the Buccaneers, they selected Jackson with the first overall pick in the 86 draft. And as promised, Jackson turned down the Buccaneers' $7+ million 5-year contract. And instead, he signed a $1 million 3-year contract with the Kansas City Royals in baseball. So the Buccaneers, they forfeited his rights before the next year's draft in 1987 for football. And Jackson was selected in the 7th round of that draft in 87 by the LA Raiders. Al Davis, the owner of the Raiders, he was a fan of Bo's, and he was very receptive to Jackson playing both baseball and football. And a 5-year, $7+ million contract was negotiated where Jackson would be permitted to play the entire baseball season with the Royals. And then when the baseball season was over, he would report to the Raiders. And that was true and okay with Al Davis, even if it meant that Bo would miss some NFL games at the start of the season. And in addition to this, by the way, Davis gave Jackson the highest salary of any non-quarterback player in NFL history. That didn't hurt either. So the two-sport legend was born. And he thrived at the top of both sports until injuries got the best of him. And he was electric in both sports. So our dedication is to Bo Jackson. Bo, who knows how to reach the top in a pair of sports. On to our pairings of distraction and reality. those sort of polar opposite twins for the episode. And our first pair of these compares and contrasts, it falls within the arena of higher education, and it's got a direct connection to who we just discussed. In very late 2023, late last year, the Wall Street Journal performed what I thought to be an excellent analysis of the state of finance for a specific particular state land-grant university that was where Bo Jackson attended and roamed the playing fields of, which, of course, is Auburn in Alabama. And the Wall Street Journal analysis did an excellent job of highlighting how higher education has become one giant and expensive distraction. Now, I've had this on the far middle list for months, and we finally have our chance to discuss it today. Recognize that Auburn was ironically built on a model of serving Alabama's working class. And that is a trait that just about every land-grant university had, including my alma mater, Penn State, not that long ago. Not anymore, though, as data prove. And let's start with the budget of Auburn. So back in 2016, which was the most recent data that the Wall Street Journal analysis assessed, in 2016, Auburn had a budget that totaled $1.2 billion in today's dollars, which was an increase of over 80% from 2002. Now, to be fair, enrollment at the university also increased during that time, but enrollment only went up by about 20%. Now, when budget spend is up 80%+ and enrollment is only up 20%, it doesn't take a mathematical genius to figure out the cost per student has skyrocketed. The justification for the skyrocketing spend that you hear from the leadership of the university is that it was competing to be the best and it wanted to excel. And those things don't happen for free. It takes money. But here's a question to ponder. What if every college and university across the land aspires to be the best and to excel, which they all do? They all aspire to do that. It creates a little bit of an arms race where everyone is racing to spend, and there are only so many students who are going to end up going to college. If universities and higher ed are not accountable on top of all this, like, say, private sector businesses are accountable, then that arms race and the exponential increase in spending, they continue unabated when they should stop or be reined in. A prior president at Auburn summed up this view with, quote, "In a lot of places, it's an arms race for new scientific equipment, for new athletic facilities, for upscale inviting dorms. It never seems to end," end quote. A lot of the spending went toward new buildings all over campus, a new animal teaching hospital that cost over $70 million, 8 new dorms that contained suites and single bedrooms that cost over $100 million, a new basketball arena that cost $80 million, and it comes with a museum, in case you were wondering, a massive student union center that ran a tab of $40 million, and then included a game room and a Starbucks. All the spending drove up the debt load of Auburn, not surprisingly. And in 2016, the university had to spend $60 million to pay down its debt, which was triple what it spent toward debt reduction in 2002. Now, when you're building all this new stuff, overhead costs are going to go way up. In 2016, the school spent more than double on utilities what it did in 2002, with the total utility bill in 2016 being $30 million. And the spending on what most would consider wants and not needs, or dare I say what some might call luxuries, it continues. The school spent almost $2 million to relocate a Starbucks to a larger space. And about a decade ago, it opened a residence hall mostly dedicated to athletes, which cost over $50 million. Now, those dorms have queen beds, living rooms, flat-screen TVs, and nice countertops in their kitchenettes. And speaking of dorms, the cheapest option on campus is almost $7,000 for an academic year, which was double the cheapest option back in 2001 after you adjust for inflation. And sometimes, depending on the room, on-campus housing can cost $13,000 for the academic year, which is almost triple what it was back in 2001. Eating when you are a student at Auburn, that isn't cheap either, and it has gotten much more expensive. Dining plans can cost over $5,000 a year. And by the way, meal plans are not optional. They are mandatory, even if you live off campus. The hiring of staff who are not teaching faculty, that has skyrocketed. And this is, of course, not unique to Auburn, but you find this across all of academia these days. Auburn spent in 2016 over $500 million for salaries, wages, and benefits of employees, which is about half of its total budget. And that's 1.6 times what it spent in 2002 on the same line item. And as a rationale, you're going to get the obligatory statement from the university that it invests in its students by investing in its faculty and staff, which sounds nice, but it hides the truth that most of the hiring and an increased portion of the spend is for non-teaching staff. The number of faculty since 2002, when you forward to 2016, it went up by about 10%, but the number of administrators within the bureaucracy of the university went up by almost 75% over the same period. An example that I saw was within the College of Liberal Arts, where spending on that college's leadership and the administrative staff there, it grew by 170% when you compare 2016 to 2002. And the budget for the Office of the President was over $4 million in 2016, which was almost a 400% increase from 2002. But if you thought that was bad, consider the budget for the Board of Trustees of Auburn. It went from what was less than $100,000 in 2000 to $1.4 million in 2016. That's a 1,400% increase. Yikes. Now, I mentioned those athletic dorms and the new basketball arena. The spending on athletics at Auburn, it doesn't stop there. The 2016 budget saw over $100 million in spending for athletics, up 140% since 2002. Over $6 million in student fees are taken for athletics each year. And in between that time period, 2002 to 2016, Auburn's spending on every major sport in the analysis that I reviewed, which included, by the way, basketball, baseball, swimming, gymnastics, and others, increased by more than 50%. Oh, and with Auburn being in the SEC, there is football, of course. And the school spent $30 million on its football program in 2016, which is more than double what it did at the turn of the century. Clearly, higher education has a spending problem that ends up ultimately in the lap of taxpayers and students. And in some instances, it lands in the lap of taxpayers twice after the students either default on their loans or the federal government decides to forgive the debt without any congressional approval, which basically makes it unconstitutional. But there is an interesting comparison to what is going on with colleges and universities that serves as a point of inspiration. And that is what is occurring at community colleges, at least typically. And that reality serves as quite the contrast to all the excessive spending on distraction in places like Auburn. If you assess the community college student body, you're going to find that almost a third work while attending classes, and that roughly one third of students who work, they're doing so over 30 hours a week. 15% of community college students hold down two or more jobs. And if you're familiar with the community college model, you'd know that students are less likely to be living on campus in some sort of cushy set of dorms with all kinds of beautiful landscaping and architecture surrounding them. And instead, they're going to be living in the real world and typically are juggling all kinds of real world issues. Transportation to and from class, work schedules from those jobs, and in many instances, childcare. Yeah, the community college model breeds a culture of doers, focusing and bearing down on the tasks and challenges at hand and not worrying about what the next trendy protest or sit-in issue is going to be. Because when you're working and when you are in the real world and attending college on top of it, you don't have time for those things, for those distractions. Acting up and rebelling takes time and money, and most community college students don't have the luxury of such distraction. Now, there was a frustration expressed by an organization that lobbies students to protest. And the frustration dealt with students at what it referenced as commuter schools, which is basically code for community college. And this organization was lamenting that there weren't formal outlets set up to consult and lobby students as to how to protest, or as this organization put it, advocate. Yeah, they viewed busy students who attended class and then went home or to their job at the end of the class as a problem. That says a lot, don't you think? How about we make a connection to another pair of contrasts? This one connecting to community colleges, many being located in larger cities, and looking at what city leadership in this nation's largest urban centers are worrying about these days versus what they should be worrying about. First, let's talk about the distraction. San Francisco, recall our Bay Area focus a few episodes back, serves once again as a great example, dealing with, of all things, pickleball. you know, the racket sport that has basically replaced tennis all across parks in this country and that is played by both young and old. Well, in San Francisco, there's a huge fight brewing over public pickleball courts and local community residents. Many residents, and in many cases quite wealthy ones living in million-dollar-plus residences, they're starting to come to hate the idea of pickleball courts near them in public parks or playgrounds. The racket of the pickleball players are causing endless rackets with noise to those residents. Now, this being San Francisco, you hear the issue from the residents' perspective put into all this squishy and politically correct word salad that we've become sort of used to or accustomed to. So here's a statement that I particularly enjoyed reading. Quote, "The endless racket threatens the fragile ecosystem and our community's prestige," end quote. Give me a break. What's funny and ironic is that some of those objectors who are living in the mansions, who are lobbying city leadership to halt pickleball playing, they're people who themselves have installed private pickleball courts on their properties. That's rich, literally. Now, all this squabble has the San Francisco Recreation and Park Department running all kinds of analyses and doing all kinds of work. There's acoustics engineering studies and zoning plans to convert pickleball courts back to tennis courts and so on. It's endless. Now, I would think that the Recreation and Parks Department in San Francisco, it would have much bigger things to worry about. You got the homeless crisis. You got parks with filth and needles from drug use. You got crime, all of that affecting parks and recreation. And certainly you'd think that city leadership, whether it's the mayor, city council, or the different administrative bodies, they all have different and bigger problems to deal with than this war over public pickleball courts. And not just in San Francisco, but across all the nation. And I found a reality issue that serves as a nice contrast to the pickleball distraction. And that is what's happening to K through 12 attendance of students after COVID and the mandated shutdowns of schools. Herein lies a real problem, an issue that city leaders should be focused upon. Everyone, right, knows the pandemic shutdowns drastically hurt school attendance. That's no secret. Schools closed, and then when they reopened, student absence soared compared to what it was before pandemic. And even in 2024, years after schools reopened, most school systems across the nation, and particularly those in urban areas and suburban areas, they're seeing new, higher levels of student absence. So check this out. About 15% of students nationwide in 2019 were chronically absent, which means they missed 10% or more of the school year. And it's not looking much better. In fact, might be looking worse for where we sit today. Not surprisingly, as we see time and again, poor families and their students, they suffer more, and they've shown to be now more chronically absent from school. But the step up in absenteeism and chronic absence are seen even in the richer school districts. In many instances, absenteeism is almost twice as high in 2023 as it was in 2019. In majority white districts, chronic absenteeism went from 13% in 2019 to 22% in 2023. And for majority non-white districts, chronic absenteeism went from 17% to 30% over the same time frame. In our nation's capital, the DC school district said that more than 40% of students were chronically absent during the 2022-2023 school year, including 60% of high school students. It's no wonder competency scores in math, science, and reading are plummeting. Now, I know what you're thinking, because I'm a big believer and thinker along the same issue. The primary responsibility for making sure that students attend grade school or high school, that's going to sit with the family and with the parents. And you're not going to get an argument from me on that. But when you start to see data like the data we've discussed, there is a point in time and a level of absenteeism where the institution and the school district and its leadership, they need to do something to respond to what is effectively a crisis. And worse yet, if the institution or its administration is enabling the crisis in chronic absenteeism, then it's time for immediate focus from leadership above, whether urban or suburban, whether political or administrative. So stop worrying about zoning for public pickleball courts and start focusing time and attention toward making sure that students attend school so they can at least be in a position to begin learning basic stuff when it comes to comparing these twin issues our city governments are focusing on and ignoring, respectively. You getting a feel for these pairings that we've aligned for this episode? Well, here's a third pair that is quite interesting, both dealing with climate change and how the West focuses upon it and deals with it versus how other nations view it and deal with it. Let's start with what's going on in Europe. Now, when I first read about this, I thought it was satire. I assure you it's not satire. Last year, there was an organization that was made up of a couple of thousand of elderly Swiss women. And the purpose of the organization was to, believe it or not, brand Switzerland, their home nation, as a human rights abuser. Why was Switzerland wanting to be viewed as such by these ladies? Because this group was saying that the effects of climate change were so serious that failing to address climate change, to the satisfaction of this organization at least, constituted a gross mistreatment of the human species. Yeah, that's what their organization was created for, and that's what the objective was. But it gets worse, because things didn't stop with this organization of elderly Swiss women. They took their case to the European Court of Human Rights. And the European Court of Human Rights agreed with the Swiss women and found that by failing to impose caps on CO2 emissions, Switzerland had violated its citizens' basic standards of decency. Here's the European Court of Human Rights. Here's what they said. Given, quote, the serious adverse effects of climate change on lives, health, well-being, and quality of life, that's the phraseology they used, the petitioners, meaning the elderly Swiss women, deserved redress. The court ruling, if you want to call it that, offers no right of appeal, and the judgment is legally binding. Now, this is the same European Court of Human Rights that labeled Russia, Iran, and Syria as human rights abusers. It now adds Switzerland to that list, which tells you all you need to know about the European Court of Human Rights. How silly. So that's what Europe and its institutions are focused on these days, in an increasingly unstable and chaotic geopolitical world, mind you, which is why I will pair that with what is happening with climate change in China and Russia and other places around the globe. Read an interview recently with Tony Abbott, who was the Prime Minister of Australia from 2013 to 2015, and he had some very interesting insights when it comes to how our allies, the ones who are under duress at least, and the adversary nations that are opposed to us, how they place climate change within their prioritization and decision-making strategically. He said, quote, even if the global warming hypothesis is correct, a couple of degrees of warming over several decades wouldn't justify the extreme steps that we are taking, the economic revolution that we're undertaking. A country which thinks that the greatest economic, political, and moral challenge of our times is climate change is, at the very least, going to be extremely distracted if it comes to fighting a war or even running a Cold War. The Ukrainians aren't worrying too much about climate change right now. I don't think the Israelis are obsessing about emissions at the moment, end quote. Now, he went on to point out the ridiculousness of the West's attempt to force an energy transition. He said, it is one of those transitions where the public is rarely asked. It's an elite project which has been foisted on the public. Excellent. Too bad Mr. Abbott is Australian and not running for public office again, because he'd have my vote when it comes to his views on geopolitics and foreign policy and where climate change ranks relative to other threats. And he serves as quite the contrast in reality to place up against the optics and code red theater of the European Court of Human Rights and that group of Swiss ladies. Time to head into a close for this episode of Pairings. So let's wrap it with a pair of happy birthdays in the world of comedic entertainment. June 19th, our premiere date for this episode. It marks the birthday of two legends of childhood Saturday mornings for millions of adults, your host included. First, Mo Howard, as in Mo of the Three Stooges. He was born this day in 1897 in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn. Now, Mo's distinctive hairstyle, by the way, came about when he was a boy and he cut off his curls with a pair of scissors, and that produced that irregular shape approximating a bowl cut that we all came to love. And we're going to pair with Mo another birthday boy on June 19th. This one born, or maybe I should say created, in 1954. That's when Taz, the Tasmanian devil, The Warner Brothers cartoon character was created by Robert McKimson and Warren Foster, who were of Looney Tunes and Merry Melodies fame, and he first debuted in the cartoon Devil May Hare, as in H-A-R-E, as in rabbit, as in Bugs Bunny. And that cartoon was under 4 minutes in length, but it was magic, and I know it well. Well, we started with Bo, and we ended with Taz, completing a nice string of connections and pairs in between. That's how the Far Middle works, and we'll see it in action again next week. Be good.